C6, number 7B.
All right. What then would we see here? We have Christianity as Christianity. That Christianity vertically we have here as a realm of ideas. What is the effect of the realm of ideas? The effect of it is actually demonstration. If we have a coherent, consistent reflection, 100% reflection of ideas, we are at the point of something more than reflection, of demonstration, which is a sense, naturally, of exaltation. That's why we can understand that Mrs. Eddy starts in that chapter by saying that if we can answer this objection, that it will lift, elevate, she says, elevate theoretical Christianity to practical Christianity. So we could write down perhaps this: coherent reflection of ideas. Coherent reflection of ideas elevates a theoretical to a practical Christianity. Before I go to the next chapter, just let's have the flow again of these three chapters. We begin by seeing there is a realm of idea, and that realm of idea is the only true realm. All right, this is the absolute proposition. Therefore, the word aspect of it, the chapter creation, asks us to accept that realm of ideas. And if we accept that realm of ideas, naturally something happens, that we have a new creation. Instead of having the creation of illusions, we accept the creation of ideas and we have a new universe. Eternal truth changes the universe. That's the beginning of the Christianity chapters. Therefore, accepting ideas, we have a new universe, and we ask ourselves now, what does that do? What is the power of this new concept of accepting the realm of ideas? And you know, in that 10th chapter, I haven't touched on it when we did the 10th chapter, the introducing paragraph is that wonderful paragraph which says that actually these ideas are that spiritual origin that are responsible that in the material world we have such a rapid... Yes. With great rapidity, the material world has fought many useful wonders. Huh? Yes. And it shows that it hints to that, really to that... Gosh, I don't find it, so we leave it. With great rapidity, thought has brought forth many useful wonders in the material world. But then she says, from where does it come from? It came really from that spiritual origin. So we can see that it is again the idea, the spiritual idea, that is responsible for all the progress that is going on in the world. Therefore, when we look at the world and see the progress in the world and see that they approximate more and more the statements of the textbook, we give that as an example of the working of the idea and not by saying that we deduce from the material sciences something useful for us. What happens in the world can make us aware of the idea that is behind it and of which we may not have been aware before. That is possible. I think we were never aware of the divine idea of cybernetics until the world brought forth the concept of cybernetics. It was that which wakened us up and said, Oh, they say there are other laws at work than the laws of cause and effect, that there are laws at work that are self-organizing and self-regulating. And then one became aware that actually Mrs. Eddy was talking about these self-organizing ideas long before. So not only in that sense, what happens in the world can be a help to us. They can make us aware of something which we may have known consciously or unconsciously or not even known, but that they make us aware to look out for them and then suddenly see that in the textbook. So here too, we have in the 10th chapter a sense that the moment we accept in the 9th chapter the realm of ideas, that this acceptance of the idea has a Christ, has a terrific Christ. And I think we should be aware that whatever we do in the way of fundamental spiritual thinking will have its impact on the world, and that the world will respond to this. Just as we have seen over and over in John Dawley's times, especially in the 1940s, how practically parallel with his new insight into matrices and into the chart and into the calculus, at that very same time in the world, we had the birth, really, of the communication theory, of the cybernetic theory of Wiener, of the general system theory of Bertel Lanfi. All that happened at the same time, parallel. They don't need to happen on the same date, because one never quite knows when an idea is born, either spiritually or in the world, because even if the book comes out in a certain year, it may have taken 2 or 5 years to write that book and bring it out. So the concept of it may have been born much before that time. But at least we should see at so many examples now, looking backward retrospectively, that it is actually so that the spiritual idea has a Christ and brings forth many useful wonders in the world. So, with the 10th chapter, we know that an idea has a Christ. But the 11th chapter comes in and says, get that idea absolutely in its purest sense, in its consistency and coherency. It's interesting that this term consistency and coherency only occurs really in this chapter of the textbook, in no other chapter, and therefore indicates the accent that this chapter has within the whole textbook. It shows, therefore, that we have to go over, in consciousness, over the concept, what is idea? Idea reflecting all other ideas, and only when they reflect all other ideas, they can really be seen as pure idea, and then it gathers a new quality, the quality of demonstration. So reflection is demonstration, pure reflection is demonstration. You know how John Dawley used to bring that out in the 1949 Oxford Summer School, always when he did take Luke, always showing in that Christianity sense that actually when we want demonstration, we must have pure reflection. So that here we get the demonstration, but where does demonstration take place? Is it taking place just in pure reflection in the realm of the real? Well, in the realm of the real, from the absolute standpoint, there is always perfect reflection. But what makes it to be practical? Only when you take it in into our consciousness. Taking it in into our understanding, it becomes our consciousness, and as it becomes our consciousness, it demonstrates itself in our experience. Therefore, the need for a further chapter, the chapter 12 on Christian Science Practice. Chapter 12 on Christian Science Practice showing us really that we have to understand scientifically the whole idea. What is this understanding? And there we have the 12th chapter that shows us that actually practice is demanding four big aspects. I think you remember them from last year, that we have made, I think we did make last year a chart on the chapter on practice, and we had four columns in that chapter. And I'd like you to make a mental note right now of those four chapters, because I will come back to it again in a day or two, so that I can refer really back to the whole structure of that chapter on Christian Science practice. You remember how John Dolly showed that this chapter has a first part that takes only in a few pages, and that first part depicts what? It depicts really the character, the attitude of the practitioner. So practice starts in with depicting first the spiritual attitude of a practitioner. Naturally, with a practitioner, we don't mean a professional practitioner. With a practitioner, we mean everyone that practices Christian Science. So every student is his own practitioner. And depicting here, from the point of view of love and mind, the loving attitude, or the attitude of perfection, that the practitioner first have to have towards the patient and the case. Meaning that the attitude is that we go out from seeing, mind, perfection, love. Or that perfection, love, is seen everywhere, mind. So instead of seeing a Mary Magdalene as a sinner, instead of seeing a patient as a sick man, instead of seeing somebody as dying, love and mind ask us to see that what love sees through mind, capital M. Love's mind naturally only sees perfection. But what is quite interesting here is that this whole chapter starts with an attitude of the practitioner, not so much with what he is knowing, what he is thinking. It's much more what he is from the point of view of his own perfection. It's insofar interesting, and we'll see it tomorrow perhaps, to see that that's what enables really somebody to practice is not so much how to think aright, but it's much more how to be aright. The spirit, what one has in oneself, is actually that which enables a practitioner to be a practitioner. It isn't so much that what one hears or what one thinks very often when talking with Christian Scientists, that they feel that the power of a demonstration lies in thinking right. Here Mrs. Eddy would start out and say, no, first you have to be right. And the righter you are, the better. Yes. So she depicts here in that first part the attitude, the inner attitude of a practitioner through the seven synonymous terms, depicts those qualities which the practitioner himself must first express. Then, you know, we had a second and third column, which we called the treatment, the treatment that the practitioner gives. The second column was what the practitioner has to know. He has to know, mind, what? Truth. So the whole second part has a very strong accent on truth and mind. Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. This is the medicine of mind. Therefore, in that second part is depicted the truth that the practitioner has to know. The truth that the practitioner has to know. Naturally, she depicts it in a very general way, because she has to give the principle of practice. Therefore, she takes in practically no practical case and says, well, if you have a patient that has TB, or a patient that has a stomach trouble, or a patient that has a heart disease, she doesn't do that. She naturally has to give the fundamental principle of truth and mind, of knowing the truth. Truth healing through mind. And so we have there a great elaboration, seven times by seven, the truth that we have to know fundamentally about reality. That's the treatment the practitioner gives fundamentally. Then, you remember, there is a third column, and that third column we have tried to depict as the method of treatment. It is, according to John Dorley's layout, life and soul. Life and soul. It's the life method that is depicted there. And what is that life method? It's life and soul. It's that life method to be unwavering soul, to be untouched by the material sense testimony. That soul sense of being absolutely untouched by anything else but by the treatment you have been giving, truth and mind, and not to let that treatment be touched by anything else. And therefore, one gets there a great sense of sticking to that what truth and mind has been telling us. Can you see the relationship? The second column, we begin to realize what we say, we begin to realize in the treatment the truth about the case. Because we know it is the truth that through mind, capital M, is healing. But then, that third column, the third part, is saying to this treatment, stick to that treatment. Don't let it be touched by anything. Don't let it be touched by fear, by ignorance, by sins, by sense testimony, by human opinions, by false diagnosis. Don't let it be touched by anything. Stick to it. It's a terrific sense of claiming and standing, really, to what one has, can you say standing to or standing for, what one has established in consciousness in the second column. It is that unwavering attitude. It's really, when I read those passages, I always think of Paul, because Paul has had that terrific sense that is brought out here. And it always reminds me of the Christianity matrix that we had in the epistles. Because, will you remember that? In the Christianity matrix on the epistles, the index J, you know, the side index, had these very qualities that Mrs. Eddy brings out here in the third part. We had there as the index, you remember, that the word said, You have to accept the new faith. In Paul's words, the understanding. Then the Christ went on and said that you have to claim really that new faith and claim it until it brings transformation. And then Christianity came in and said, you not only have to claim it, you have to steadfastly abide by your vision, by your new faith, by your vision, by your treatment. Steadfastly abide, and you have to abide and abide and abide and abide and abide and abide until you win the victory. Don't give in. And Paul naturally was that very example of never giving in. He could be chucked out of a town, he could be stoned, he could be in prison. Nothing could keep him back from standing up again and go forward again, and with the same enthusiasm to go forward again and never be held back. So here too, in a scientific way, Mrs. Eddy now presents that third part as the method that says, stick to your vision, stick to your understanding. Don't let you be sidetracked by anything. You see that third part at once, when you remember how the very first thing that Mrs. Eddy says there, that she says that if a blundering dispatch would reach you announcing the death of your dear friend, you will be very sorry and worried about it and sad. And then if next day there comes a correction of that telegram and says, no, your friend is okay, you will be happy again. So what made you unhappy? What makes you happy? A blundering dispatch. Not the reality of being. The reality of being was that your friend was always okay. And in this way she introduces there right away the sense that the law of being, that the law of being, life, that the law of being can never be touched by anything, soul, life and soul, that which is, and what is, that which in the second part we have established as the truth about the case, that truth about the case, now in the third part, is the fact of being, is the isness of being, and nothing should touch it, and we shouldn't let it be touched by anything, nor by what people say about it, nor what the doctor says about it, nor what the diagnosis says about it, not what the prospect is about it, not what the physical senses testify about it. Just stick to the idea and be a sticker, a real good sticker to the truth. And then in the fourth part, we know it's a part on mental treatment illustrated, where Mrs. Eddy shows that this treatment, second and third part, that this treatment has an effect on the patient, that it now affects the patient and heals the patient. Why? Because there is one mind, and therefore she takes up right at the beginning the fact that it is one mind and not argumentation. There she deals really with arguments at the beginning of that fourth part and shows that argumentation is only an auxiliary until we have the spirit of truth and love, and that it is only really the spirit of science that heals because it rests on one mind. That the mind of the practitioner and the mind of the patient is the same mind, namely the mind of God. And that is why a treatment can heal somebody far away, because it is not the practitioner healing a patient, but it is the one mind manifesting itself as the one mind. And so in that fourth part, we see the impact of the treatment on the patient. Yes. So how could we epitomize this 12th chapter? Perhaps just by showing or saying a scientific consciousness a scientific consciousness of ideas heal. A scientific consciousness of ideas heals. Yes. All right. We make a break here.